market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that doesn't have $1 billion to throw around, but other companies might. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Dr. Anir Bhanumathi. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain. I'm signing in.
Yeah, signing in.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
You like
mate? You're on board with the puns.
Yeah.
Just remember, I'm the comedian here, dude.
Oh, okay.
Just for the record.
Okay, we'll change.
Mate, we've got a lot to talk about. We have got to talk about things that are to do with signing in. We're going to talk about $1 billion that one company just made kind of magically appear. We will talk about the streaming wars and the company that you love and I, well, put up with. And I'm going to jump on the high horse yet again, mate, 2 weeks in a row. Plus, if we have time, we will have time, don't worry, we will get into the full mailbag. You excited?
Is the horse bored?
Are you excited?
I'm just wondering about the horse. Is the horse bored?
The horse is happy.
Okay, I'm very excited.
Let's get into it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, this week we found out that TPG, well, some people at TPG, managed to make $1 billion appear. Literally, with a stroke of a couple of, well, stroke of the virtual pen, a couple of cells in an Excel spreadsheet, and voila, $1 billion just appeared out of nowhere. Now, I don't know about you, I'm going to try that trick with my bank account, see if it works. I don't hold out high hopes. What I'm talking about, of course, is the ongoing court case between the ACCC and Vodafone and TPG, who are hoping to merge their operations. And the reclusive CEO of TPG, David Teoh, we have to officially call him the reclusive CEO. That's what all newspapers do. Who hasn't had his photo taken in about 10 years. The big exciting news was this new photo of David Teoh doing the rounds, other than that old grainy shot of him getting into a car somewhere. So brand new photos.
I was getting excited about that one. That's very exciting.
I know. So TPG was going to build a mobile network. And the boffins did the numbers. And according to evidence given by David Teoh, the net present value, the fancy phrase that econocrats and analysts used to talk about the full value of the project that was underway, was going to be a negative $300 million. In other words, doing this would cost the company $300 million. And allegedly, David Teoh says that Macquarie said, guys, I can't do a capital raising on that price. Can you go away and have another look for me? And lo and behold, the wonderful bean counters and spreadsheet jockeys at TPG came back, and all of a sudden, it was a positive $800 million. How good's that?
That sounds awesome.
All you've got to do is change the number of customers, tweak the length of the model, add back some other numbers, and look at that. You turn a $300 deficit, $300 million loss, miss, reduction in value, call it what you will, into a positive $800 million, and all of a sudden, Macquarie can get the capital raising away. How good's that?
That sounds awesome. You know, I'm going to say one thing about this.
Tell me.
My favorite line.
Yes.
Is all models are wrong.
Right.
So only some are useful.
There we go. There's a punchline.
So the question here is, was the minus 300 million model useful or was the plus 800 million?
Well, it's very useful, mate, because it got the capital raising away. How about that? That model was useful.
So exactly. That's what I was trying to get to. Is that the plus 800 model was useful because it served its purpose.
Now, as much as it's fun to talk about TPG and David Teoh and the ACCC and all those wonderful fun things that us analysts like to talk about, that was kind of the bigger story here, right? Is that, and it's not really the story, but it's kind of the thing that underlines all of these conversations is anyone, anytime, particularly those who practice a very quantitative style of investing, will put a spreadsheet together and say, right, if I put these numbers in these boxes, I end up with a number, and that number is somehow the answer to my question, right? It is the value of the shares, or it is the future value in TPG's case of an entire mobile network. To some degree, again, just there but for the grace of a couple of numbers being different, you can get a very, very, very different outcome from a spreadsheet. It's not to say you should never do the numbers, and as you say, all models are useful. So, you know, to some degree, it can help you understand an issue, help you frame a decision. But when something can change that dramatically, and it was, you know, a change from 45,000 customers to 60,000 customers, which is, 15,000 is a lot. On the other hand, we're talking about less than 100,000. This is a five-figure number. So there's so much. Of course, we also remember back in the day that more than one toll road had gone broke because of overambitious forecasts. So a couple of things. First is if you're an investor, just be a little bit careful with the way you're using spreadsheets to work out value of the companies you own or you're investing in or you know, the future expectations you have. The other thing is also be careful of companies doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, it's a very, the old institutional imperative, to use a really wanky corporate term, the idea that people kind of are obliged or inclined to want to make things look a certain way. If you're in the mergers and acquisitions team of an organization, I'll bet you have a more positive view of a potential merger than maybe someone else from another side of the business who isn't quite so invested in getting the same project off the ground. You know, human biases are so strong here. If you want to be a conservative bean counter, say, look, I've allowed for all the possible things could go wrong, that's how you get a really, you know, significant negative value on these things. Well, maybe the number of customers will be half, and maybe the cost will be double, and maybe the price will be lower. And you put enough of those, you know, assumptions in, you can make anything seem terrible. On the flip side, you can make the Titanic look unsinkable, funnily enough, if you put the right assumptions into the same spreadsheet. So, again, Doc, I can't do better than your line, which is?
Well, you know, all models are wrong. Only some are useful.
There you go. I think that's a really, really important one to take away.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, speaking of models, speaking of usefulness, it turns out a little company that I frankly had only heard of a couple of times called I Signed This, in the world of technology companies putting an I in front of everything, is it useful sometimes. Although Accenture could probably be a case of it not going so well. I Signed This is in the news because their shares crashed during the week, absolutely fell out of bed, because it turns out that the company's executive team would get a bonus, I think it was some extra shares vesting or something, if they got over $5 million in revenue. And the report I've read suggests that their revenue was $5.002 million. Now, for those who aren't doing the maths at home, that's effectively $2,000 over their target. And it was something $60 million worth of shares, or 60 million shares, whatever the number was, roughly the same thing, because the shares are about a buck each, give or take. That's a pretty good payday for exceeding a target by just a little tiny bit. Now, the shares didn't fall for that reason. They fell because there are now allegedly some concerns about how that revenue recognition, to use the accounting term, actually came about. In other words, you can collect the cash, but they're not measured on cash. They're measured on revenue. In other words, how much of that cash they got could actually be applied to what the business had already done. And there are some concerns, allegations, allegedly, which suggest that maybe management might have been a little bit aggressive in the way they did that, so they could just trickle over that $5 million number and it will get paid out quite handsomely. So, mate, again, this is one of those stories. I mean, the case of the likes of, you know, incentives, models, other things, another buyer beware situation. What do you know about us signing this, and what are you kind of taking away from the whole episode thus far?
So I don't know much about, well, I know a little bit. So the company's basic proposition is that it's essentially a know your customer equivalent service. It's a know your customer. So you know, if you are doing a banking transaction, you know, through a third party, you know, you're using an application that needs, you know, you need to do some money transfer. Somebody needs to validate that, you know, you are the person that you are.
So okay. That's helpful.
It's an important service.
Yeah. So the likes of, well, we know the Commonwealth Bank was taken to task by ASIC for allowing large amounts of transactions without knowing who it was doing it, what was going on. I signed this in theory, solve that problem for some customers in some circumstances.
Yes. So that's the thing. And they have the customer base in Europe and so on and so forth.
So far, so good.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things here. Like, this company had at one point, I'm not even going into the pros and cons of what they are doing. I mean, you know, like, I mean, one could in theory say that, well, you know, why does a bank need to know your customer? I mean, bank already should know their customer if they have an account, right?
Right.
But maybe if you're doing electronic transactions in a third party with a bank, maybe you need it. So that aside, though, I mean, one big thing for me was that this company had very tiny revenues. Right?
Well, this was an 18-cent stock back in March.
Yeah.
6 months later, it's trading for, I'm going to look at the chart right now, well over $1.64.
Yeah.
That's a nice, almost ninefold return in 6 months.
6 months,
Now, the shares at the time of recording, we should say the market's about to open on Friday morning, so goodness knows what will happen, but they're now 93 cents. That's depends where you bought the shares. You're still at 4.5 times if you bought them 6 months ago.
Yeah.
If you bought them on Thursday afternoon,
you're not so happy.
You've lost half your money.
Yeah. Some basic, like, I mean, without going into too much detail, I mean, if your revenues are, you know, a few million dollars and you have a market cap of $1 billion, then either you're...
That's
It's a lot, right?
Yeah.
Your market opportunity, or what I call, like, you know, total addressable market, has to be humongous. There better be very few competitors in that space, and it's likely that you're going to win a substantial piece of that market. If all those things are true, maybe the market cap is justified at that point, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, so I don't know why. I don't have a good explanation to why it was trading where it was trading. So that's one. There was a report out on AFR. On the Fin, which was talking about how the reconciliation periods were changed, mm-hmm. and how that had an impact, apparently, allegedly, in terms may have resulted in this, you know, this revenue target or this cash target being mm-hmm. met, so that all these shares could vest. Some other flags were raised in terms of, you know, who about the ownership and so on, which is neither here nor there. So, I mean, you know. Again, if nothing, I would just look at the valuation. You know, it's hard to understand. I find it hard to understand the valuation. So that's my take.
I think that's interesting. So, this is why, look at the ISO on this story is get the headlines. We all, it's the financial markets equivalent of a soap opera, right? So we all love that. We all love dramas and slow moving car crashes, and that's all fine, interesting, and whatever. That's what we want to talk about, though, is not, you know, we don't want to just talk about the tabloid headlines, because they're okay, but they're not very useful. Most of our listeners hopefully don't own or sign these shares, or if you did, hopefully you bought them at a much lower price and you're still well ahead. This is very much more a story of, as you say, mate, the sorts of companies that you invest in, the sorts of risks we're taking. And you've highlighted beautifully exactly that. So the first thing was, this is a company with, as we know, $5.002 million worth of revenue and $1 billion market cap. Mm-hmm. Now, my simple math says that's about a 200 times sales mm-hmm. valuation. I'd ask you about the PE, but I don't think there's an E, right?
There is no E.
So, again, to your point, if you're worth $1 billion, let's just put some numbers on this, right? Let's say eventually you want to trade in a PE of, I'm going to be generous, call it 20. Mm-hmm. That means you have to, at $1 billion market cap, have a profit of $50 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you would have to take your revenues well north of, let's say, $100 million at the very, very least, right? Being really, really generous. Let's say you keep half of the revenue. Now, take tax out, you take costs out. It's almost not going to happen, but let's assume you could. That's still a 20-fold increase in revenue you have to get just to justify the current price, let alone any sort of gain from there on, right? So if you're a share market investor, you want to get a gain of hopefully at least 10% a year, because that's what the market's done on average in the past. But just to get square at a reasonable PE,
Not PE even. You're talking about PS, right?
No, by the time you get profit of $50 million, you probably have to have sales of $100 or $200 million, right?
So yeah, a lot more.
you've got to grow sales by a factor of 20 or 40 times just to get a PE that's at 20 times earnings. So like drawing that right back, that's the size of the challenge ahead of a company like this. Now, it may happen. I don't know whether I sign this will do it or not. It may well. Hopefully, we're back in a year's time telling everyone how great the company's done.
Mm-hmm.
But to do that, to get to that sort of level, there's a lot of hurdles to clear. There's a lot of opportunity that you have to be able to seize, not just prepared to, but able to, in the face of competition and everything else. And you've got to ask yourself as an investor, do I really think that a $5 million revenue company is worth paying $1 billion for? Now, again, maybe it is. Maybe this is the exception that proves the rule. But just be very, very careful. Just because tech stocks are hot right now, and they are, and we'll talk about this in another podcast probably, just because tech stocks are hot right now doesn't mean every tech stock is worth buying, and it certainly doesn't mean that you should be throwing your money out willy-nilly just on the latest hot stock, because frankly, the hot stocks tend to be the ones that fall precipitously from overly high levels without being able to justify the sorts of gains they've had. Now, again, I'll contrast that with the stuff that is worth paying up for, which is the really high growth stuff that has quality businesses, quality operations, usually decent profits as well. So I'm not saying all tech is bad. I'm definitely not saying, though, all tech is good. And just be very, very careful. Just because the stock's going up, just because your mate or your taxi driver or your neighbor's got it, doesn't mean you should rush headlong into it as well. Otherwise, as I said, if you bought stock on Thursday afternoon, you've done half your dough already. Anything else to add, Ben?
No. The stock is up, according to ComSec.
This morning, is it?
Yep.
Dear, dear. Roller coaster continues.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, this is the segment you make me do under sufferance, because it involves some fruit company, mandarin or tangerine or
this is a
tangelo
great,
or
this is the
something.
Best segment.
Yeah. Oh, dear, oh dear. Unfortunately, I couldn't say no this time, because there was some meaningful new news in the streaming wars this week with your favourite company and my, well, I don't mind. Berkshire owns it, so you kind of work for me. I am Berkshire, and you own Apple for transparency. Mm. Apple released a very, very, very attractive cut price offering in the streaming wars. Now, Netflix, the big behemoth of the business, Stan and Foxtel here in Australia, Disney Plus announced a couple of weeks ago, Apple the latest to enter the fray, not unexpectedly. In fact, we would have been all, you know, knocked over with a feather if they hadn't announced something that was pretty well flagged. But Apple is now going to enter the streaming wars with Apple, what's it called? Apple
TV Plus.
Apple TV Plus. So Apple TV was always the box, the device. TV Plus, their new subscription service, made $5 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's cheaper than Disney at $8.99, cheaper than Netflix at, what, $10.99,
$11.99?
Mm-hmm. So it's a hell of a lot cheaper than anything else. Is this a game changer in streaming? What does it mean for the way we consume our content and the way we use our devices?
It's not a game changer. The game changer was Netflix, right, many, many years ago when it changed the game. I think the main thing here—
And just to be clear, you've got to think back a few years now. Changing the game away from cable television, everything bundled together,
DVDs,
get the lot for $100. Right, exactly, DVDs even before that. They kind of popularized, literally legitimized streaming.
Yeah.
YouTube kind of around the same way in a very, very different way, but Netflix was the first subscription streaming video content business.
That really took off and had the word net in it, right? I mean, it reminds you of
Netflix.
And it reminds you of Netscape, which is like, you know, for people who remember, was the browser of the day.
Wasn't it?
Right.
So, I used that back in the day, Netscape. Navigator, as I recall.
Netscape Navigator, right? There so it has go. All these, you know, connotations about it being the original, you know, disruptor.
Okay.
Right? So I think that the interesting thing here is, I mean, Apple could not have priced this product at a much higher price point because they're going to have only 9 shows, maybe 9 very high quality shows.
That's not much for $5.
Yeah, it's not much for. I mean, exactly, it's not much for $5, right? So, I mean, how much would they charge?
Right. Are people even going to sign up for 9 shows? It feels like. I mean, even if they are high quality, it's kind of like. Well, you might as well buy. It's like paying up $5 a month to borrow 9 DVDs from the DVD shop, right?
Exactly. But here's the thing, right? So they're going to have then a show come up every month, or a series approximately is going to be added. So they're trying to do basically be instead of being a factory of content, they're going to be very selective. They're going to be like the HBO equivalent.
So it's even more like, I think in my mind, a movie studio. I mean, they release a couple of, you know, one big new release movie a month or something.
Exactly.
It's more like, so you're kind of almost subscribing to new release movies from one studio.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, they want to be like the Pixar in the TV world equivalent, if you think about it.
Now, that makes sense.
So that's all interesting. And I think it's, you know, what I thought was more interesting with their approach was not what they are doing, but rather the way their go-to-market.
Okay.
I thought the go-to-market was really interesting because what they have said is for a limited time, when they have less content, anybody who buys a new iPhone, new iPad, a new Mac, and a new Apple TV, the box, gets 1 year free TV content.
It's a pretty good free trial.
That's a pretty good free trial. And given the number of devices Apple sells, that's like, that would probably mean 200 million odd subscribers in 1 year. Right now, they're making no money off those 200 million people.
Yeah.
But it's quite likely.
It's a good way to see the market.
It's a good way to see it. And all of a sudden, Apple would have more subscribers than Netflix.
Right.
Right.
Admittedly, for free.
That's
why I think Channel 9's got more subscribers than Netflix kind of does, but that's a different story.
But then the question is, how many of those people are going to actually leave?
Right.
And that probably is, you know, at that point you'll think, oh, it's got enough content, you know, I've got $5, it's not a big deal, etc. Well, that's one angle. I thought that was really interesting. The other angle here, I think, is if everybody's fighting for the incremental subscriber, this changes the game for fighting for incremental subscriber because it makes it just harder to find that incremental subscriber. You know, I've got a $5 is going to, you know, Apple, maybe, you know, $8 is going to Disney. Mm. It just means for somebody like Netflix to find that incremental subscriber, the job is harder.
Right.
Especially if your stock trades on an incremental subscriber basis, that becomes even harder at that point. So I think I thought that was the interesting, I thought it was very aggressive on Apple's part to go this route.
Mate, I'm notoriously pro Google. I'm not really anti Apple. We kind of play it up a little bit, but I have to say I'm not surprised Apple's getting into this. I am wondering whether Apple can genuinely be an ongoing high quality player in this market if it's only got a very, very, very limited amount of content. I mean, if Netflix had tried to launch with only originals, it would have probably not been around today, I would speculate, right? It did well because it got to license a whole lot of everyone else's content, show it for everybody, bundle a whole lot of stuff up. the idea with Netflix is now you kind of get it because there's always something that you can watch, right? There's always something to watch. Maybe you've seen it before. You probably haven't. Series, TV shows, comedy, stuff for kids. My young bloke watches plenty of Netflix just quietly. Probably too much, but that's a different question. I mean, I get the point of the captive subscriber because if you're getting it free, so why wouldn't you use it? On the other hand, if I've got to choose between, frankly, cable, which still does exist in here and in the US, a Disney Plus, a Netflix, you know, YouTube, everything else I've got an option to consume. If you said to me, you can sign up just to, let's pick Warner Brothers movies, right? If you could pay $5 a month to get every Warner Brothers new release movie, I'd be like, oh, no, not really. Thank you. I'll kind of wait and see it on some other platform at some other time. Like, just it isn't enough for me to make a decision. Is this the thin end of the wedge from Apple? Are they going to add more and more content, become a bit of a Netflix? Is this always going to be ancillary to their business? It strikes me it's not quite hefty enough to really change the game material, or at least to keep meaningful numbers of subscribers. If you've got to make a decision, is Apple going to be your first, second, or third choice? I just don't know that it necessarily will once you have to start paying.
I'll just say one thing about Apple. I mean, the thing with it, if you are competing against Apple and you are a sole content company that relies only on content,
yep,
you're up against fighting a very hard battle. It's basically the battle that Fitbit was fighting, which basically Fitbit has lost, right? I think Apple has this strategy always of entering in a small way.
Okay.
But you've got a captive audience, right? You can be guaranteed that you're going to have 200 million subscribers. Mm-hmm. You can then observe how those 200 million subscribers are going, right? And that's 200 million are going to be basically the 200 million devices that have been sold this year.
Right, we get it for
plus,
it, yeah.
Plus a bunch of other people who are probably going to say, okay, I'm going to try it out for $5.
Yeah, yeah.
They get to see what works and they get to adapt their strategy accordingly. I would say this is probably going to be one of the largest streaming subscription businesses in the world.
Mm.
And I think they're going to follow the HBO route where they're going to have enough content, but not a lot of content. So it's not going to be like Netflix, which basically is producing zillions and zillions of content.
That's right.
But they'll take the HBO. I think the other factor I think that's going to play out is once you've got, and I'm not saying it's doomsday for Netflix or anything, but what I'm saying is that once you've got Amazon Prime, once you've got Netflix.
Amazon Prime, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got, I would say this is Apple's gateway to being Amazon Prime. Basically, everything in Apple is basically going to be available as a subscription, including, phones and whatnot, right?
Okay. So you have an Apple membership at some point.
It basically becomes an Apple membership, right? And Apple has figured out that one way to expand your reach is to offer these different things. Mm. And the more different things, touch points you've got, the more chances you've got of actually acquiring customers. Remember, Apple's market share is pretty small, right? 15% or 12% or something like that. So, if you can incrementally bump that from 12% to 20%, that's huge.
Yeah, totally.
Right. So I think that's the strategy. And the strategy is, and over time, maybe something like Warner Brothers or something else gets, basically they can't fight out against all these big guys. So they're going to get sold. Somebody's going to buy them. Mm. So there's going to be some consolidation.
That's the other fascinating thing, right? There are so many streaming options now. So Channel 10, now part of CBS down here, have their own thing. The free-to-air guys have got their own catch-ups. You've got Stan, you've got Foxtel Go, you've got Netflix, you've got Disney Plus is coming, KO, the Foxtel Sports streaming thing. This Amazon Prime you've already mentioned. There's probably a dozen I can't think of right now. I mean, YouTube has its own premium subscription model. It strikes me that these guys can't all survive standalone. If we fast forward 5 or 10 years, they can't. Well, maybe they can, but I guess the benefit that they're all global, right? Other than the local guys, so to some degree, you can afford to be a small share of a global market rather than a big share of a local one. So that's one thing going for it. But at some level, to your point about Warner Brothers and others, this has got to shake out some way, shape, or form, right? We've got, on one hand, you've got content streams from the likes of producers like the movie studios. You've got platforms, the likes of, probably Amazon is probably a good one, or the Roku box, for example, or even Foxtel to some degree, where it's kind of a platform with its own kind of bundled content. And then you've got the true bundles like a Netflix and like an Amazon Prime, maybe more specifically. I don't know that I have a view on how this ends up, but it strikes me that it's unlikely that we'll have so many content producers, so many platforms, so many bundled solutions. At some point, this has got to be meaningfully concentrated. I don't know if anyone goes broke necessarily, but I've got to figure there's a whole lot of consolidation.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Yeah, there's going to be a whole lot of consolidation. And I think it's, again, I think if you're a standalone streaming business, it's going to be hard, given that you've got all these, there's no dearth of money for Apple to produce content, right? I mean, it can produce basically any content it wants.
That's right. Buy half a dozen small countries.
Yeah, and it could buy, it could buy.
Maybe buy Greenland.
It could buy Greenland.
Give it to Donald.
That's true.
It could, a president,
if,
Mr. President.
If nothing, it could buy something like, you know, Lionsgate movies or something that, right? I mean, you know, there are lots of small movie studios. Mm. But yeah, alternatively, you don't even have to buy them. You just have to pay money to produce the content that you want to produce.
Right,
and I mean, yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Plenty going on. Mate, are you ready?
I am very ready.
The starter is on his podium.
Go for it.
Stand by, fools.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Oh, mate, I'm up on the high horse. I'm going to start off slow and I'm going to build up to a crescendo. I'm going to peak at exactly the right moment here. I noticed in the paper today an article in the Australian Financial Review. We are recording this on Friday, as I've said. The headline is, "Divesting Coal is Weak," says the Host Plus CIO, Chief Investment Officer. And this brought me to remember an article I'd written a little while ago. I think we might have even spoken about it in the past, about the folly of what I call ethical investing. And I want to just touch on this a little bit because it just really gives me the irrits that people are spending money, wasting money with fund managers and others who are promising ethical investing as if it's a world-changing pursuit. And I don't mind people investing the way their consciences dictate. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful idea. I would absolutely always say invest in things you want to own for the reason you want to own them, because you get to keep them and do the right thing, right? If you feel good about what you own, you're less likely to sell in a fit of pique at some inappropriate time. So absolutely buy the stocks you believe in, buy the companies you believe in, hold them for as long as you believe in them. That is absolutely all completely legitimate. Sam Cecilia, though, the CIO of Host Plus, in the paper today, is quoted, it's actually a tweet stream, such as the modern world, mate. This is a series of tweets turned into a newspaper article by somebody else. He basically has complained about the fact that people are trying to get him to divest some unethical, in air quotes, companies, and that somehow that's going to give a better result for the environment, a better result for his members, a better result for something else. And so here's what he says. He says, this is quoting from the article. He argues that dumping shares in fossil fuel companies is a, quote, waste of time because those shares will be bought by other investors with the associated emissions, therefore continuing unabated. He goes on to say, activism has wasted precious time focusing on coal divestment rather than reducing coal burning. Divestment is one investor selling shares to another investor, ineffective at combating climate change. He says, divestment is weak. Climate change is a very serious threat, but you're wasting your precious time fighting investors when you should be persuading governments around the world to take action now. This is exactly what I've been saying for the longest time. If you want to Google something, Google the inconvenient truth about ethical investing. Whack Scott Phillips in there, just in case it doesn't come up directly. I've outlined exactly why, and Sam has actually nailed it completely by saying basically the challenge with investing in shares is you are exchanging them with somebody else. The company if I buy your Apple shares, mate, Apple doesn't get a cent. If you sell me your Apple shares, Apple doesn't get a cent, and Apple doesn't know nor care which one of us owns those shares. And this is exactly the problem. I think the climate change issue is a massive, massive one. Our listeners may not agree, at least all of you. If you disagree, that's fine, but I have a very, very strong conviction that climate change is a problem. 98% of the world's scientists agree. And if we're going to combat climate change, you don't do it by swapping shares with the other bloke. There's absolutely no point in you selling all your coal shares to me or me selling all my coal shares to you. It makes absolutely no difference to the planet, no difference to corporate decisions, and is a complete and total waste of time. If you want to put money into things like clean energy with new funding, go for it. Otherwise, take your profits, use them to combat climate change by changing your consumer behavior. Change your vote. Go and protest if you want to. But for the love of God, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever whether or not you own the shares or someone else owns the shares. It might make you feel better. It has absolutely zero impact on the climate or whatever other ethical approach you're trying to enforce or influence. It just simply does not matter. In fact, if you believe it matters, it's even worse if you sell the shares because you're not on the register anymore to actually go and make a noise at those annual general meetings. You're actually better off owning the shares and making your view felt than trying to argue and yell from the outside. I feel better now.
You're feeling awesome.
I feel so much better.
That's great.
This is cathartic. I like this. I go into the weekend in a much better mood having purged my demons.
You should just do this every time.
You think?
Yeah.
Well, Alison might disagree.
So the question might be whether or not our listeners are happy with it.
I'm not sure if anyone's still listening.
There we go.
Anyone there? Hello?
No, hello? Hello, hello, hello.
Stand by.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Of course, there are still listeners, Doc, because we're about to get into our favourite segment, the Motley Fool Mailbag. And I did a tease last week, and unlike the last time I did this, I'm actually going to come back directly and answer that question rather than forgetting for a week and leaving our members on tenterhooks, or our listeners on tenterhooks, I should say. We got a question through, as I said, from Jai last week, and I mentioned the question but didn't have a chance to answer it. Here is our chance, mate. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Jai has two questions. He says, firstly, infrastructure investments. With global economic growth slowing down and with bond yields around the globe at record lows, is now the time to invest in infrastructure investments. Governments around the world are able to borrow money at record low rates and use the funds to build roads, railways, airports, etc. to help stimulate their economies, which flow to the infrastructure companies involved. It seems like an obvious investment, but am I missing something here? He mentions a specific one he was looking at. Mate, infrastructure investments. I know you're not really an infrastructure guy. It's not your core investment thesis. But thinking about Jai's suggestion, if we follow his train of logic, rates are low, governments are A, able to borrow at very low rates, and B, looking for opportunities to stoke economic growth. Infrastructure, therefore, because governments do these things, seems like a natural place, natural beneficiary of such government largesse, or maybe just economic stimulus, depending on which way you want to look at it. In any case, does that not give a really nice tailwind for, and therefore make good investments of, some of those infrastructure businesses?
Well, so I think it's reasonable to expect more, you know, company, let's build more, you know, railroads, let's build more tollways.
Bridges, tunnels.
Let's, you know, build airports, do stuff like that.
There you go. That
all makes sense.
The Western Sydney Aerotropolis,
yeah,
which is the world's worst name.
You know, let's just get the biggest airport in Western Sydney.
keep going.
That's all fine. And I mean, there's truth that will help the infrastructure companies, right? So, you know, something like, you know, if Sydney Airport was participating in it or like, you know, but here's the thing. The question is, has that potential tailwind already been priced into the share? So that's number one, right? I mean, ultimately, you're looking to get a combination of share price appreciation and, you know, some dividends from these companies. Most of these companies pay a decent dividend, right?
And unless you're the first one to the party, you've got to work out whether or not, if you're right about the trend, but it's already priced in, then there's no market beating potential left.
Yeah, or, you know, it might not be that big. And, you know, you have to just figure that out. I mean, that's not that easy. That's number one.
Right.
Number two is, like, I mean, it's a relative question, right? I mean, do you want to get, you know, maybe you're going to get a 1% performance relative to the market with something like this. You could invest somewhere else and maybe get a little bit more. Right. So there's all this question of alternative opportunities. You know, is this the best opportunity one can find?
Okay. So even if it is potentially market beating, it's still the question of is it still the best market beating opportunity?
Right. Or rather, even the question is this something that fits your needs in the sense that, you know, maybe if you're looking for a combination of income and share price growth appreciation, then this is maybe something. But if you are not in that phase where you don't want you're not really interested in the dividends and you don't want to pay taxes on the dividends or whatever it is, maybe this is not for you, right? So, I mean, there's all these other considerations that come into play. Frankly, I mean, you know, some of the infrastructure companies actually look pretty expensive right now. There's been a lot of yield chasing going on, right?
Well, that's the other problem. These are seen as, to some degree, what we call bond proxies. In other words, when rates go down, these things go up because their yields are more and more attractive. And it may, again, once the news is already priced in, you might be paying up for the trend and for the opportunity for some higher dividends. So you're concerned the tide's all the way in?
It's hard to, I mean, what I think is that some of the quality companies look expensive, or at least on a historic basis look expensive. Now the question is, of course, historically the rates have not been this low, so you have to factor that in. It just becomes a little bit more convoluted in terms of figuring out. This is not straight up growth, right? I mean, in growth investing, you basically say, well, you know, is there enough growth? If there's enough growth, even if I'm wrong by, you know, 20%, 30%, I'll still probably be okay if you know, the growth has that rough. That trajectory, right? Here you kind of have to get the a better handle of the value, which frankly is not really my skill set. But I mean, to me, it appears that some of these companies are have that. I'll add one more thing.
Yep.
So, like, if some company is building toll roads, as an example, and and you are expecting to, the fact that the government is building more toll roads doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to actually be paying. There's the same number of people going through the roads, right? I mean, it's not that all of a sudden there's going to be a 10% growth in population that's going to drive somehow the tail growth. Right? I mean, you
that's
know,
fair,
it's so, I mean, you're basically diverting traffic from one end to the other end, right? I mean, the same story with airports, right? We could put two airports in Sydney, or we could just keep the Sydney airport in Mascot open 24 hours, right? They roughly have the same effect, and you just smooth out the load.
But for investors, at least, if you're taking a toll road rather than a public road, there's money being made by an investor somewhere. So by diverting that traffic, by kind of putting in that fee-generating machine, it can add value for investors at some level.
Absolutely. All I'm saying is that the growth here you're looking at, you know, you're probably looking at top-line growth in, you know, 5%, 6%, maybe 7%, 8%, right? Mm-hmm. You're not looking at blistering 10%, 15%, 20%. Just because the government is putting in money does not mean that it's going to generate 20% growth.
No. But so it can be more, right? If Lendlease has twice as many projects because the government wants to build twice as many bridges, there may well be some meaningful change to those guys.
True.
To your point, if Transurban opens another couple of tollways, there's some incremental volume somewhere.
So I have mixed feelings about this. I think he's right. You're right about Jai is right about the trend. So you need to make an investment decision based on whether or not there's value there.
I like it, mate. Jai, I think you're bang on with the question. I think, look, the best thing about some of this stuff is the thinking behind it, and you're thinking exactly the right way. I will echo Doc's point about just being careful that the sort of not priced in, right? Just because you see a trend doesn't mean it's a great trend. Plenty of opportunities. You know, again, I'll use the well hackneyed example of during the dot-com boom. You know, most of those ideas, the internet's going to be huge. Yes, everyone's going to pay online. Yes, everyone's going to shop online. Yes, everyone's going to search online. Yes. And then have a look at how pets.com or Yahoo or, you know, someone else have done in the meantime, even eBay of latter days. And even those who did were successful. Microsoft took 15 years to get back to its 1999 share price peak, right? So if you're thinking about, you know, were those investments worth making? Was the trend right? Absolutely. Were those companies worth investing in at those prices at that point? Well, history would say, it's easy in hindsight, but history would say absolutely not. So just be careful about how that's been done. Doc, second question from Jai.
Mm-hmm.
It's tech stock remuneration, which I think you wanted to think about being your pay, but this is not about your pay.
I thought it was about my pay.
Mate, your 50 bucks a week is safe. Don't worry. He says, my second question might be more up Doc's alley, but I'd love your thoughts too, Scott. That's very kind. Thank you, Jai. I've been watching the stock Live Tiles for a while as I think the business is interesting and they have partnerships with Microsoft already in place.
Mm-hmm.
However, the share price dropped last week. So this is 2 weeks ago. Although revenue is up over 200%, they are burning through cash paying for staff and management, and it seems unsustainable. What are your thoughts on A, Live Tiles as a company, and B, whether overpaying staff at a young tech company is normal or dangerous for investors? He finishes by saying, thanks, gents. And of course, bloody love the podcast. Good man, Jai. Doc, tell me, let's go the way around first, actually. Let's talk about remuneration, then we'll talk about Live Tiles. Does overpaying staff in a young tech company make sense? Or is it something that investors should be throwing a red or a yellow flag over?
So number one is you never want to overpay people. You want to pay the people the right amount.
I'll keep that in mind next time you ask for a pay rise. Good.
Check. I'm underpaid, right? So I should always be paid more. So, but it's only when I'm evaluating others do I say that. You should be paid right. But yeah.
Duly noted.
Yeah, don't forget my pay rise. Mm-hmm. That aside, I mean, so I think Jai's question is he's saying overpaying, or rather he's basically saying that, you know, there's a substantial chunk of the revenue disappearing,
right?
Paying for staff and management, right? So that's a question. I would not say it's overpaying. It's rather the question is the company still at scale, and the company has not yet hit the scale at which it can demonstrate that there's, you know, operating leverage. By that fancy term, what I mean is that, you know, your operating costs are not increasing as fast. As they're increasing right now, because right now you're not at that scale, right? Mm-hmm. So you're trying to grow fast. In an attempt to grow fast, you need to, you know, have more salespeople, and you need to pay, you know, salespeople by their weight in gold. Mm-hmm. So it's costing you money. And the hope would be for a software company is that you want them, you know, you hope that the software is sticky enough that therefore your revenue is going to be locked in for, you know, a number of years, and therefore that incremental revenue in the future does not actually cost you anything because you've actually got it locked in.
Right.
So that would be the idea. So, yeah. So, I mean, in this particular case, I would say that, you know, they're basically trying to get to that point at which, that it'll become scalable.
And this is a challenge. We talked about, I signed this earlier. This is a challenge for all young tech companies, right? You need a certain number of people to give yourself a chance, a shot at the big time. it's very hard to bootstrap yourself to $100 million worth of revenue with two people working on the business. I mean, if you're very lucky, that's the world. I'll run that business if you give me the option. But but ordinarily, you're going to need sales and marketing staff. You're going to need programming staff. You need some, in theory, people who know the business of business. You need some finance staff. At some level, you have to pay overs early. Not to your point, not necessarily overpay staff, but employ more staff than you can currently justify on the current level of revenue. Because if you don't do that, you won't be able to get to the next level of revenue. And so frankly, that's the risk, right? And we've said this many times. This is the risk with smaller companies, is they are absolutely taking that risk of overspending now with hopes of earning it back later. If they do, you make a fortune. If they don't, you go broke. But that is the story of, particularly in this day and age, man. This is kind of new. We haven't really talked about this a lot, but in the old days, you had one widget factory, and then you might open a second one, or you put a second production line in, and so you can kind of scale production, right? You start off in your street, then your suburb, then your, you know, region, then your city, then your country, then internationally, and you used to grow really slowly. Mm. These days, with particularly online businesses, where it's a land grab, almost all online businesses are land grabs, right? You want to get big as quickly as you can because someone else is trying to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You kind of front load that. And so there is more risk, but also more potential return. I think that's part of the reason we're seeing big, big, big valuations, and frankly also big profit growth with companies that have managed to do this, is if you want to get big, you got to get big fast. And so you're having to front load, and this is where the VC market is taking off as well. You're front loading all this expenditure saying, right, we've got 18 months to go from zero to 100. If we make it, we're genius. If we don't make it, well, someone else is going to beat us there anyway. And so we don't have any other choice. If you want to be successful in this particular business, and not Lifetiles in particular, but whatever it is, you have to get there fast and at scale. This is kind of the Uber Lyft story, right? If Uber hadn't got big fast enough, Lyft would have beaten them to it. And if Lyft didn't do it, someone else would have beaten them to it. Once the opportunity is there, you kind of have to get big and get dominant super fast.
Yeah, so I don't have anything to add to that. I mean, so back to...
That's because I basically repeated what you said, sorry.
Yeah, there's a beauty to this capital light model. You know, it's not like building factories for cars, right? So it's going to, you know, the fixed costs are pretty small, the gross margins are pretty high, mm-hmm. the incremental selling the same software to any number of people is basically costs you nothing extra, right? It's mm-hmm. just cost you something in terms of salespeople. But it doesn't cost you, don't have to build a new factory.
You build the car once, you sell the same car to everybody.
Yeah, exactly, which is weird. So that's good. Now, back to Lifetiles. I mean, so what do I think about Lifetiles? Well, it's a company that we've recommended in Extreme Opportunities. Actually, we recommended it in August.
Nice.
So this is, you know, it's got like it's not a $1 million revenue company. It's not a $5 million revenue company.
Okay,
it's got
good.
About its annual recurring revenue at the end of fiscal 19 was about $40 million.
Okay.
Right. And that was up 167. That's not nothing. 167%. They have a partnership of sorts with Microsoft. And here's the thing, right? They've grown that annual recurring revenue from about $4 million 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
To $40 million. That's a tenfold increase in 2 years.
Still relatively small. If I'm looking across the, you know, Woolworths does $50 billion in annual sales, and Qantas and Telstra do large numbers. $40 million is good, but you know, in the broader scale, still reasonably small.
It's reasonable. So, but this is a small company too. It's like $200 million market cap company, right?
It's better than I signed this market cap.
Well, yeah, and I mean that company has less than five, million in revenue or something like that. Oh, this company has $40 million in revenue. 5.002. If it had the same multiple as I signed this would be a huge company, right? So this would be an overnight multi-bagger. So that's that. The partnership with Microsoft is both a benefit and a risk, right? So the benefit is that you are riding the coattails of one of the best mm-hmm. software enterprise companies out there today.
Okay.
So that's one. They have a huge sales force. They have got their feet, across the door in so many different places.
Right.
If they can co-sell stuff, that's great.
That's kind of nice, right? If your business card's got the Microsoft logo on it, it's a pretty good starting point.
Yeah. So, I think they're doing well. I mean, this company has over 900 enterprise customers. They've got some very big logos that they've signed. So Lifetiles, I'm talking about. So they're leveraging this relationship well. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that's also a risk in the sense that, one day if Microsoft says, hello, bye-bye, you're in trouble. Right.
And so this was the same. So Vita Group, V-I-T-A,
yes.
was it owns and operates most of the Telstra shops in the country. And that's great while Telstra was growing nicely and looking after you. When Telstra says, we might do it ourselves, or maybe we might give you less money per handset, per plan sold, you kind of got nowhere to go, right? So the downside is that while things are going great, you're a hero. When your big you know, huge part and says, I'm going to tighten those screws a little bit.
Yeah.
There's not much of a foot to stand or leg to stand on.
Yeah. So I think that's the risk, and that's the risk you need to be cognizant of.
Right.
You know, like if there's a mutually beneficial relationship here, as long as that lasts, that's great. You know, maybe Microsoft can, you know, acquire it and stuff like that if they think it is, you know, I'm not saying that an acquisition is a possibility, but I think the market recognizes some of that and recognizes the fact that it is not yet profitable, it's burning money, and therefore it has the multiple it has, right? And again, and it's sense. Not fortunate enough to have signed up valuation, but if it had, it would be a different story.
And that's the thing, right? I think that's important too. You mentioned, we talked about infrastructure before and growth stocks. And it, I mean, look, in a perfect world, you'd buy the company that had the best potential in the world for the lowest price possible and make $1 squillion. The reality is that's very rarely available. So you're always looking at a company's current valuation versus its long-term potential. And sometimes that means going from small to medium, and that's as big as you're ever going to get. If you deal with, you know, left-handed coffee mugs, your market's only ever going to be so big. If you deal with oxygen, then your market is pretty much the world, right? So horrible examples because I thought about them on the spot. But if you think about that, you know, is one or either business better or worse? Well, I mean, in a perfect world, you'd like the largest total addressable market. But if you had to pay, you know, $45 trillion for the oxygen company, or you could buy the left-handed coffee mug company for a buck, well, that changes the story. It doesn't mean that you've got the same market opportunity, but nor do you necessarily need to, depending on how much you're paying for the share. So a Lifetiles that maybe doesn't have the same size business as an Apple or an Amazon eventually, still can be a really, really, really great investment, can still multibag from here. You don't have to be the biggest company or have the best market opportunity potentially, as long as you're paying a decent price and for a business with some decent growth ahead.
Yeah, I have nothing to add.
Good man. Either you weren't paying attention or I did a good job. I won't ask you which.
You did an awesome job.
Maybe we've got lots of questions in the mailbag, but we've only got time for one more just because we do value our listeners' time. Well, you wouldn't know that from the length of some of our previous podcasts. We're trying to be a bit more disciplined. This question is from Ben, mate. And Ben writes a lovely question. And his aim, I'm sure, is to understand more from us.
Mm-hmm.
Or Ben just wants us to fight. And I haven't quite decided which. So, Ben, I'm going to spin the wheel of fortune. I'll do the baby John Burgess, for those who remember back in those days. And I will ask Ben's question. Ben says, question for the Australian podcast. Hi, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast.
Awesome.
Good man, Ben. This came via Facebook, by the way. I'll tell you about that in a second. As a subscriber to Share Advisor and Extreme Opportunities. Now, I run Share Advisor. You run Extreme Opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I have been comparing the two types of investment styles. If you were to report both services' performance over the last 2 years, which service has outperformed the other and by how much? P.S. I've had to change the equalizer settings to vocal on my car stereo due to Nirvan's deep voice. Cheers, Ben. Ben, I'm gonna pretend that wasn't a compliment for Doc because you know that I don't do it that way. If you've got something nice to say it about me, please. but Doc, you're doing a good job as always. So here, that's the question from Ben, mate. EO versus SA, Extreme Opportunities versus Share Advisor. Which would have done better over the last 2 years, do you reckon, and why?
So, I mean, I'll start by saying
you answer that question.
So I'm going to start by saying that actually, they're two very different services, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if I think comparing them is a bit like comparing apples to oranges. That's number one.
You had to smack apple, didn't you? You couldn't say oranges and mandarins. You had to say apples.
You know, apples are apples. Everybody knows about apples, right? So I
always
think that,
bloody apple.
So, like Share Advisor would focus on essentially more mm-hmm. blue chippy companies, mm-hmm. but you know, I'm not saying exactly blue chip, but you know, companies that are in the process of becoming blue chip, and have some growth, but you know, they'll likely be profitable. They'll probably pay a dividend. So they've got a growth prospect, but it's not like go growth, mm-hmm. right?
Now we should say just quickly too, mate. I actually should have started by saying what they share in common is you and I both make a recommendation once a month.
Yeah.
Of one stock on the ASX. We actually have a US stock and Share Advisor as well, but for our purposes, one stock a month on the ASX. So we're in the same sort of cadence. Our job is to try and beat the market.
Yeah.
And we try and give our members stocks to buy, as I said, one a month, with the aim of beating the market over 3 to 5 years and probably longer. So that's the similarity.
Yeah.
The difference, as you said, starts with the types of companies we choose. And you were mentioning SA has, you know, medium, large. Compared to EO, which does what? Yeah,
which does really, like, you know, smaller. It's really fishing at the smaller end of the pond. It's looking for higher risk but higher reward companies.
Right.
It would likely have a higher fail rate and so on and so forth, right? So that's number one. So I think, you know, we can't really directly cover. Both services are like beating the market over the long-term track record that they've got. I mean, Share has got a much longer long-term track record mm-hmm. Versus EOE as a relatively young service. If you're just specifically comparing last 2 years, I mean, last 2 years have been very heavy growth-focused. You know, I have not done the calculations off the top of my head. My guess would be maybe that, you know, Extreme Opportunity may be doing slightly better than SA because share-wise, or largely because I think the market has been that type of market as well. That's another thing. I think mm-hmm. this is something investors don't think about, but you should think about it, is that market sentiment also, to some extent, defines how returns work in the intermediate term, at least, right? And if the sentiment is that, you know, I'm not going to pay for value stocks or the stocks that look like value, I'm not going to pay for, but I'm going to pay more for like growth stocks, you know, that's going to play a role. So I think, yeah. So, I mean, it's a great question, but at the same time, I mean, there's no great answer, at least for me, because I think that it's hard to... And here's the other thing. One last thing, then I'm going to just shut up. It is hard if you are building just a portfolio out of EO. That's going to be really hard because, you know, that's going to be a very, very volatile portfolio. You can do it, but it's going to be very volatile. So, I mean, at a portfolio level, there is room for different strategies that you need to use to actually have a more balanced, you know, portfolio that takes care of risks and rewards and things like that. So I think that that's the thing. And again, you know, I think the cycles change, things change. So I think that's something that people need to, you know, like, you know, if you think about being an yield investor, it's like yield investing is, you know, in many ways out of favor, in the sense that, you know, people are just getting the yields, but you're not going to beat the market easily with the yields right now. So
because high yielding has been bid up so much, it's hard to buy them and beat them on a capital gain perspective.
So that's the thing. So again, you know, got to be mindful of that. That's, you know, Captain, you want to add stuff?
I'll add a couple of things just quickly. Doc is dead right. So he was very modest. EO would have absolutely beaten SA over the last 2 years. I think that's, I haven't done the numbers either, but I'm absolutely sure that's true. And basically, as Doc says, to some degree, that's because of the favorability of the types of stocks. Now, I don't mind Berkshire Hathaway, as members might, or listeners might remember. Doc doesn't mind Apple. I would go so far to say, mate, there were 2 or 3 year stretches over the last 20 years when both Apple and Berkshire, probably at different times as it turns out, would have actually lost money for investors. And so, again, there's no excuse for me. Doc's on much better than I have, and probably that's probably because he's got a better stock picker rather than because the market was kind. But let's assume there's part of that at least involved, just for my own ego's sake. At some level, that's the reality, right? So if you think about, okay, Berkshire would have lost money at certain periods of time over 2 years, maybe even 3 years. Apple almost certainly would have done the same. You know, which stock was the best over the last 2 or 3 years given those time periods? Well, sometimes the answer would have been Berkshire. Sometimes the answer would have been Apple. Over 20 years, they've both done spectacularly well. I think Apple's probably outperformed Berkshire over that period of time in total. But and so that's a valid question too, by the way. All I would say is just over any 2 year period, even if the numbers were reversed, Doc's done a great job. He's beating the market. There is 6 stocks on the EO scorecard that have more than doubled since July 2017. So that's a very, very good track record. I expect to see many, many more of those gains. One of those is a triple, by the way. So, you know, those things will continue to happen, I expect, on EO. As Doc said, they're very different services. We try and beat the market overall on average over the long term, but we do it differently. Doc has got more stocks that have done better and probably more stocks that have done worse than ShareAdvisor. We probably have a narrower band of performance. Because of the types of stocks we're looking for. Doc is looking for the absolute big winners that are the next Apples, the next Amazons, the next eBays, the next picker company. Doc, I was going to help me with Teslas, Netflixes. Looking for the, you know, the next big winners. And they, you know, when he finds those, they will go really, really well. You've just got to make sure you buy a broad representative sample of those stocks, because there will be some losers in there as well, because for every Google, there's a Yahoo. For every Apple, there's a, help me out here, Motorola.
BlackBerry.
Yeah, BlackBerry, even better. There you go. See? So, that's the reality. So, you know, at ShareAdvisor, we have fewer of those. As Doc said, more that pay dividends. We will have more better known names, not necessarily the big blue chips, because most of the blue chips are overvalued and overappreciated. But overall, we're looking for the medium large kind of stocks in that kind of range. The ones that have more proven have better and longer track records just because of the virtue of the way they've done. Which service is better? Well, it depends on your own approach. I agree with Doc entirely, other than to say, I think you can build a market-beating portfolio out of EO. You just have to be very prepared for market volatility, right? So as an investor, if you love the, or you can put up with, high volatility, EO is a great way to go and invest. Just be really mindful that's going to happen. Now, SA is volatile too, by the way. So I wouldn't suggest in any way, shape, or form, people shouldn't expect that individual stocks or even the scorecard at large has swings. Just be mindful that's exactly what happens. And if you are someone who prefers a little bit less volatility, then as Doc said, mixing the styles actually makes a whole heap of sense. I think we'd both agree on that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you said, what, six or seven multi-baggers, right?
I think that's six. Is there seven? One, yeah, two, okay.
Well,
three,
that's
four,
a six. Let's go with six. Six five, is fine.
Six. Six, mate.
Yeah, okay, six multi-baggers, right? So there are seven that I counted would have 50% or more losses.
There you go.
So that's the
now, this is important, though, right? Because and we've said this before, and this is not just about blowing up your tires or trying to sell more subscriptions, because members, listeners can do whatever they want with that if they choose to. But yeah, and it's a bit flippant to say, except that it also happens to be true. The most you can lose is 100%.
Yes.
The most you can gain is, I mean, look at Apple's long term. What's Apple up? 100-fold or something stupid? Berkshire's up 2,000% or 2,000,000% over 50 years. I mean, the sorts of gains you can get on the big long-term winners. You could have bought one Apple and 19 losers and still made money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, when I say losers, I mean literally 19 went broke and still made money.
But the main issue is that most people actually are not able to hold for that time, right? I mean, holding for a long time is really hard, right? I mean, that's part of the reasons why, you know, people end up with inferior returns is just, you know, the holding periods are too short.
Right.
Which is why we say, you know, 2 years maybe is too short. You need to at least think 3 to 5, you know, and something like EO, actually, you probably need to think even longer because, you know, these are like baby companies that are trying to become real companies in over the long term, right?
There's so many examples of companies that have actually done really, really well in their fourth, fifth, sixth years, and that's where the money's made. And you kind of think, you know, if you get the trend right, if you get the idea right, if you get the analysis right, you've got to let that play out. Here's something I want to say. We could be reasonably accused of trying to spruik our own stuff, right? And that would be a fair criticism if that was all we were trying to do. And your listeners can decide for themselves whether we're legit or not. Hopefully, you've listened long enough to know we're pretty straight up and down on this stuff. The reality is that we actually, we're saying, hey, buy our scorecards or buy our services. That's absolutely true. But this is actually quite literally how we invest. Like our investing careers are built and or will fail on the result of our investing style. So what we're saying to you as listeners is this is exactly how we are running our services for members. And the results will manage themselves. The outcomes will show one way or the other. So if we're just spruiking to try and get you to buy stuff and you lose money, well, guess what? You're not going to hang around. So we have no delusions of grandeur. We're not trying to say, you know, here's a good reason that you should buy Extreme Opportunities other than, hey, this is how Doc actually invests. And so if you like that, that's exactly what you're going to get on the inside as well. If you're a member now already, then great. Thanks for joining. And for Ben, thank you for being part of it, mate. We appreciate you being part of both services. But that's what we do on this podcast. It's what we do in our services, what we do in our other media and everything else that we do is say, hey, here's kind of the approach that we take to investing. And if you like it, then we've got a service for you if you want it. If you don't, that's fine. The podcast's free. Keep listening to the podcast. If you never want to sign up for one of our services, you want to just take us for a ride on the free podcast, knock yourself out. If we're helping you, if we're helping Australians invest better, well, we're kind of happy with that, right?
Absolutely.
I think we're done.
That's a good note to end.
I feel spent. Before we do end, though, mate, I want to give a bit of a plug to our socials, as the cool kids say. The socials. The plural of social media is social.
Social media.
You can get in touch with us a lot of different ways. We are on all of the big socials, except for WhatsApp, because I just still don't get WhatsApp.
Are we on Pinterest?
No, we're not on Pinterest.
See, I could figure one. Are we on Instagram?
We're on Instagram. We are on Instagram. The big three, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get us. So if you want to get in touch, if you're on Facebook, we are at The Motley Fool Australia, I think it is. Type Motley Fool Australia in the search bar, you will find us. There are Motley Fool businesses in other countries, so type in Motley Fool Australia, you will find us there. I've also got a new Facebook page, Doc, is the big breaking news this week.
Wow.
People want to get in touch with us on Facebook, and some people sent me friend requests on my personal page, and that's kind of okay, but, personal page is a personal page. You don't want to see photos of my kids and, you know, interaction with my family and stuff. So Scott Phillips Money, because Scott Phillips Investing was taken, Scott Phillips Money on Facebook, feel free if you want to. Don't hurry there because there's not that much great stuff. I'm trying to post a bit there that I'm posting on Twitter. But if you're Facebook, the reason was, Doc, that some people use, or almost everyone uses Facebook, only a few people use Twitter. We want to be a bit more available. So The Motley Fool Australia or Scott Phillips Money. If you set up a Facebook page, I'll give you a plug, but you're not really a Facebook user, are you?
No.
So that's a way to get us on Facebook. If you're on Instagram, I'm at TMF Scott P. That'll be familiar in a second. And The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. If you're on Instagram, we post some stuff there. Not a heap of stuff, because frankly, there's only so many pictures of you and I that people can be bothered putting up with.
Not in my picture. Nobody should look at my picture.
Right. So if you're keen, at The Motley Fool AU or at TMF Scott P. And then going to Twitter, those two handles will work exactly just as well. At The Motley Fool AU on Twitter, at TMF Scott P on Twitter. And this time, Doc is available at Anirban Mahanti. So you can get in touch with us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Don't try WhatsApp, we're not there. Don't try Pinterest, because no one wants to see a Pinterest board of investing stuff. That is about the most boring thing I can even imagine myself. And that's saying something, because I like this stuff. You can get in touch with us if you also want to. If you want to abandon the socials, if you're stuck in the email age, it was a nicer, happier time, wasn't it?
That was a beautiful time.
info@fool.com.au is how you can get in touch. We really do appreciate it. We say this most weeks, but honestly, the mailbag is kind of the funnest part of our job, because the news of the day is interesting and the investing stuff is interesting and the high horse is cathartic. But hopefully most of the value we're giving is to answering the questions that you have and you want to know, because if you do, there's every chance someone else does as well, and you're helping them get answers to their questions. So hit us up on the socials. That's it, mate. Last job, subscribe. Like the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. Hey, newsflash. As of right now, I checked this morning, we are the number one podcast in business. And we are the number 9 podcast on the iTunes charts overall. The 9th most popular podcast in the country. How cool is that?
That is pretty awesome.
Thank you very much to all of our listeners. If you're listening now for the first time or 100th time, if it's the 100th time, have a good hard look at yourself. You've wasted way too much time doing this stuff. If it's the first time, we hope we haven't turned you off. We hope you'll come back next week. If you're just listening and haven't subscribed, please do that now. That means that when our next episode is available, it'll drop straight into your feed. And that'll be good for you, good for us, and hopefully good for more people who'll discover the Motley Fool and foolish investing as a result. Plus, you can go to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.